Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded October 28th and 29th, 2023. Well, having watched the incremental disintegration of Western civilization, such as it was, over the last 40 and something years, it still comes as a surprise to witness the depravity, viciousness, and yes, banality of the evil now run rampant. And this is without regarding the unspeakable Israel, enacting a literal genocide even now, every moment. But the revelation of the West's moral bankruptcy, Israel's ultimate crime, illustrates. Certainly the blame for the killing of Gaza is on the governments and institutions of America, Europe, the NATO nations, Canada, the rest of the Anglo-American alliance, and their satraps around the world. But the blood of innocence stains our hands too. We the people who allowed this happen and allow it continue. So now what are you and I and we to do? Dimitri Lascaris is a Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer. He served as justice critic in the shadow cabinet of the Green Party of Canada and likewise for the Green Party of Quebec. Dimitri's interviews for The Real News Network appear at their website, therealnews.com. Dimitri's articles appear at various sites online and at his website, dimitrilascaris.org, where I found his latest piece, If We Have Any Honor, We Will Defend the Palestinian People. Dimitri Lascaris in the first half. And is there method in this madness? Was the ruthless destruction of decency and the foundational principles of the West and presumably Israel the intention of the current onslaught in Gaza? Or has it all just gotten away from the perennial felon Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, originally hoping, perhaps, just for a distraction from the determined and massive demonstrations against his government? Whither Israel then, and where does the disaster it has wrought for Palestine's people lead it now? John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia, principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. Helmer has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, and his latest is Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out. John's latest article at Dances with Bears examines the question of what becomes of the only democracy in the Middle East now that its long-promised war is begun. John Helmer and the gods are going against the chosen people, Mammon against Israel, Mars against the Pentagon, in the second half. But first, Dimitri Lascaris and the great unraveling beginning in the navel of the world. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, my great pleasure, of course. Now, Dimitri, you've just returned to your home in Greece from Lebanon. What did you see there?
I went to a protest at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut on the first day, which was October 18th. That had been designated a day of rage by resistance groups in Lebanon. And that was chaos, complete and utter chaos. And then I went to the Shatila refugee camp, where I interviewed a representative of a Palestinian political party known as the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. That was a long and interesting conversation. Then I accompanied refugees after that interview from the Shatila refugee camp on a protest in Beirut, which concluded at the Palestinian cemetery in the center of the city or near the center of the city. And then I twice went to the border between Lebanon and Israel and was close enough to the border on several occasions during those two trips where I could see we were literally steps away from the border. We could see Israeli territory and military installations on the other side. And I spoke to a number of people down there whose villages have been shelled and some of whom have fled. They're internally displaced persons and some of whom have refused to flee and have stayed. So that's the summary of what I saw and did while I was there.
Yeah, I was looking at your article that I mentioned in the intro, If We Have Any Honor, We Will Defend the Palestinian People, and the accompanying video. I was really struck that you were videoing out of a moving car along the coastline, very pretty Mediterranean coastline in southern Lebanon, but that it was like a ghost town. There wasn't a person to be seen.
At that time of day, it was like 6 o'clock and the sun was setting. And it was really a beautiful day to be in a part of the country like that, which is so picturesque, quite stunning in some parts. and to see almost nobody on the roads, that seemed rather unusual. And certainly it was consistent with what I saw all along the border. Many villages had been evacuated on both sides. Kiryat Shemona, which has a population of 20,000 people, and that was days before I went down to the part of the border area that you're talking about. But they also have, the Israelis have evacuated at least 14 other communities in northern Israel. It could be many more than that by now. And the Lebanese have evacuated a number of communities. But I didn't find any community which was completely deserted. In every community that I went to in South Lebanon, there were at least a few stragglers, a few hardheads who refused to leave. That may seem odd to those of us who haven't experienced war, but the people of South Lebanon, especially the older generations, have experienced war on numerous occasions with Israel. And I think, you know, they've just fed up with leaving their homes, although the younger ones, I think, tend to seek sanctuary further north.
Well, is this evacuation a responsive evacuation or a preparatory evacuation for something larger, perhaps, to come?
Oh, I think it's both, but particularly the latter. My sense of what I saw down there, I did see shelling on one occasion. A Lebanese village was being shelled in the distance when we were standing at the border on an elevated ground. And I heard explosion on numerous occasions, even though I couldn't see the actual blasts. And then there was constantly in the sky drones, Israeli drones. And I could always hear them, but I could never see them. It was an omnipresent sound. And my overall impression about what I saw and what I heard and the reports that we were receiving about attacks across the border were, frankly, that the Israelis were the aggressor in these exchanges, that they were firing more often, striking or trying to strike more targets, including on numerous occasions, civilian targets, civilian infrastructure. And although I can't say this with anywhere near certainty, and it is admittedly speculation, my overall sense is that, you know, the Israelis may be trying to provoke a large-scale response from Hezbollah, because that will draw the United States into the fight. And the United States now has plenty of military assets in the region. It's brought two aircraft carrier groups. One or two others may be on the way. Thousands of troops have been added to the already extensive military footprint of the United States in the Middle East. So Netanyahu has been very, very clear for, you know, almost the time the man became the prime minister of Israel, I think it was about 20 years ago or more, that he wants to attack Iran. But I think he knows full well, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out why, that he alone, his country alone, could never defeat Iran. And in fact, if they engaged in full-scale warfare with Iran, they're very likely going to be obliterated unless they resort to nuclear weapons. Any real serious attempt to remove from power this government in Iran, which has always been hostile, and for good reasons, to the state of Israel, is going to require a massive military intervention by the United States. And despite all his efforts, Netanyahu has failed to do that, to convince the Americans, and most notably Obama, who negotiated a nuclear deal with Iran that Trump destroyed, even though Iran was respecting the deal, according to the IAEA. They failed again and again, and this seems like their absolute best opportunity to finally suck the United States government into a devastating rant. And personally, I think that that's where this is all heading. All indications from where I sit are that this is heading into a regional war that directly or indirectly is going to involve Iran and Hezbollah.
You wrote an article, I'm looking at your website, dimitriliscaris.org, a few days ago, "Tensions Rise on Lebanon-Israel Border." In that article, you describe almost daily attacks by Hezbollah and Israel shooting back and forth across the border. Can you describe who Hezbollah is and what role they play in Lebanon, Dimitri? They're being, by the Israeli media operation, compared to Hamas, and it seems to me that that there's an effort to make the two indistinguishable.
Well, Hezbollah was formed out of the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon which ended in 2000. I believe it began in 1982 with one of Israel's numerous incursions into the sovereign territory of Lebanon. And it went on for a long time, and the Lebanese army was incapable, it seems, of expelling the occupying forces of Israel from Lebanese territory. And so a resistance movement, which was led by people, Lebanese from the Shia Muslim community, grew up, came into being and grew rather rapidly, became a formidable guerrilla fighting force, and ultimately caused the Israelis to withdraw from South Lebanon in 2000. And then in 2006, the hostilities didn't end there. And that deal, by the way, the 2000 terms of withdrawal, foresaw that Hezbollah would be disarmed. The Israelis demanded that they be disarmed, but they were never disarmed. And they, in fact, grew to be stronger, and arguably to the expense of the Lebanese military. And so the hostilities, between the Israeli military and Hezbollah militants continued. And then in 2006, Israel invaded again. And its apparent objective was to destroy Hezbollah. Not only did it fail to destroy Hezbollah, but it took quite a beating. And at the height of that military operation in 2006, the Israelis had committed up to 30,000 soldiers. Hezbollah, south of the Litani River in Lebanon, which is the region south of that river, is where the vast majority of the fighting took place. Hezbollah reportedly only committed up to 1,000 of its fighters. So it was up against a much larger Israeli force, possessing far more modern military equipment, primarily from the United States. And again, even though the official figures suggest that Hezbollah experienced significantly higher casualties, it's not surprising given the numerical superiority that Israel had, the Israelis suffered enough casualties that they felt compelled to withdraw. And then Hezbollah became involved in the war in Syria on the side of Bashar al-Assad, the current president of Syria, and did so, I think, officially it did that because it felt that the jihadists, many of the people who were trying to overthrow Assad, not all of them, many of them were jihadists and who engaged in extraordinary atrocities in Syria. And Hezbollah was of the view, its leadership apparently, that the best way to take Lebanon from these people was to be proactive and to join in the fight with the forces of Bashar al-Assad, who was a secularist, and defeat them. And effectively they did. And now Hezbollah has far more prowess, combat expertise, and weaponry than it did in 2006. So in 2006, it was reputed to have 15,000 missiles, a large number of them being Soviet-era Katyusha missiles, which are obviously far less sophisticated than many of the missiles that are created today. Today, it is reputed by people in the West to have in excess of 150,000 missiles, perhaps in excess of 200,000 missiles, and it has missiles of extraordinarily high sophistication compared to what it had back in 2006. Not only that, but it has tanks, armored personnel carriers, extensive combat experience from the war in Syria. Israel doesn't have extensive combat experience now. I mean, there's very, very few soldiers have actually engaged in real combat in the Israeli military, the ones that are active today. The vast majority of them, they've spent their time in the Israeli military, beating on and bombing defenseless Palestinians. They haven't taken on a peer enemy. Hezbollah is a peer enemy. Hezbollah has taken on heavily armed and brutal forces in bloody combat extending over years. I'm talking about the active soldiers within Hezbollah today. A lot of them have that combat experience. So I think that if of course, the last thing I'll say before I predict the future is, of course, the Canadian government and other Western governments say that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. I have a couple of things to say about that. Well, first of all, most governments in the world don't consider Hezbollah to be a terrorist organization. They consider it to be a legitimate resistance movement. Secondly, if you are going to call Hezbollah a terrorist organization, how in God's name can you not call the State of Israel a terrorist organization? The textbook definition of terrorism is targeting civilians and civilian infrastructure for political objectives, targeting them with violence. Israel has been doing that for decades. It has done it on countless occasions. It's doing it right now in Gaza every single day, and it has done it to far more devastating effect. It has caused far more civilian casualties, far more destruction of civilian infrastructure than Hezbollah, than Hamas, and Islamic Jihad, and any other Palestinian or Lebanese resistance group put together. You can add them all up. And Israel has caused far more civilian casualties and destruction of civilian infrastructure for political objectives. So, you know, if Hezbollah is a terrorist organization, then Israel is 10 times or 100 times even the terrorist organization that Israel is. But of course, not only do we not call Israel a terrorist organization in the West, we actually support this terrorist organization with weaponry and free trade deals and with vetoes at the United Nations, you know, with the exchange of intellectual property, intelligence sharing, you name it. We are in bed, we in the West, our governments, with what is arguably the most violent and destructive terrorist organization on planet Earth at this particular point in time, and that's the Israeli government.
Well, you've just tuned in. You're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dimitri Lascaris. Dimitri is a Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer. He served as justice critic in the shadow cabinet of the Green Party of Canada and likewise for the Green Party of Quebec. Dimitri's interviews for the Real News Network are found at their website, therealnews.com, and he posts at his website, dimitrilascaris.org. His articles are there, too. We're talking around one of his latest one, If We Have Any Honor, We Will Defend the Palestinian People. Dimitri, I'm curious to know, and this is a question posed by my friend John Helmer. You're in Greece, you're a resident of Greece. He asks, and he was a high-level confidant of past President Papadopoulos, John was. He asks this question, Dimitri, why are the Greeks so passive, so contrary to their traditional support for the Arabs under fire, especially the Palestinians? We know in Canada the reaction to this has been lamentable, and there's a great quote on this by the Pakistan ambassador to the United Nations. But what about Greece?
Well, we have to distinguish, if we want to understand what is going on in Greece, between the conduct of the government and the conduct of the people. The people have actually been a significant segment of the population that's gone into the streets and has condemned Israel and demanded a ceasefire and a serious attempt to deal with the very legitimate complaints of the Palestinian people. And there have been multiple protests. And I mean, right here in Kalamata, which is, you know, where I live, it's only a town of 70,000 people, there was a very significant protest about 10 days ago, and I had nothing to do with organizing it. I found out about it. But the people here, I think, if you were to ask people on the street, I strongly suspect a majority would say they do not support Israel, they condemn Israel, and they want to see justice for the Palestinian people. The problem, I will acknowledge this. By the standard of past protest movements I've seen in Greece, this one has been rather modest. So, for example, I saw far larger protests, and they happened much more frequently, and they were more militant, in the first 5 years of the austerity program that the Troika of Greece's creditors inflicted upon Greece starting in 2010. What happened, though, Chris, is that the Greek people... It saddens me to say this, but they are in many respects a beaten people, you know, and I think a really sort of devastating moment for the psyche of Greek workers and just ordinary citizens was in 2015 when their prime minister that they had elected 6 months earlier, Alexis Tsipras, on a platform of socialist transformation, called a referendum on whether or not to accept the draconian terms of austerity that the Greece's creditors wanted to impose upon Greece, despite immense pressure being applied by the EU authorities, including a threat of expelling Greece from the Eurozone. The Greek people overwhelmingly voted against austerity. And what did the government do? This government that had been elected just 6 months earlier to undo the austerity, it inflicted upon Greece, within a matter of days of that vote, that historic vote, a form of austerity that was worse than anything the Greeks had to endure up until that point in time. And if you look at the turnout for Greek elections, over this period when the austerity began to be inflicted in 2010, it is very rapidly descended to historic lows for the post-war II period. So Greeks have lost, not completely, and certainly not all of them, but a lot of Greeks have lost their sense of militancy, and they don't see any point in protesting. But, and the last thing, you know, just quickly on the government is entirely on the side of, you know, Israel. It has been developing gas deposits in the Eastern Mediterranean with Israel. It has been engaging in military exercises with Israel. There's an Air Force base outside of Kalamata, which I drive by occasionally, where I believe there are Israeli military forces. Although they're very discreet, I have reason to believe that there are Israeli military personnel there. They've been practicing, you know, attacking Iran by air in Greek airspace. And this is all just reflective of the fact that the Greek government is, the one we currently have, is a complete vassal of the United States government. It's as simple as that. It is completely beholden to the United States government. And so it will pursue a pro-Israel policy, no matter what the people say, unless, you know, the opposition becomes very, very intense. And we haven't gotten close to that level of intensity yet.
Yeah, and in Canada, too. And as I say, the response by the Canadian government here has been lamentable. It was absolutely shameful in the United Nations trying to get a resolution against, or an amendment to water down a resolution for a ceasefire. It was totally embarrassed. At your website, there's a link to a roundtable you recently took part in at Consortium News, Global Greens, War or Peace. And in that, you say that it's not enough for the people of these countries that whose political processes are supporting what's going on, sitting back idly or cheering this genocide taking place in front of us. You say we need to get into the streets to the point we inspire fear into the hearts of the leaders. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm not suggesting that people should actually engage in violence. I am suggesting that they should shut down large segments of the economy. You know, I am suggesting that they should express their anger vigorously, albeit in a nonviolent way, and, you know, cause people in power to actually wonder whether we're on the precipice of real anger, the kind of anger that results in violence. You know, that kind of, you know, people actually make them think that mass violence is a possibility without engaging in mass violence, because I'm opposed to that 100%. But also, you know, civil disobedience, shut down the economy, go every time these, you know, these depraved, sick, I'm sorry I have to say this, you know, it pains me to have to describe the people who lead our countries in this way, but they're sick, depraved, degenerate, lying, pathologically lying, you know, the lowest of the low. That's how I feel right now, Chris. You know, we are actually not simply tolerating, we are facilitating and implicitly supporting, if not explicitly supporting, a brazen genocide. It's so obvious that this is genocide that you don't even need a legal scholar to conduct the analysis. It's just so obvious that this meets the definition of genocide, and we are in it up to our necks, the blood of the Palestinian people. The only thing that is going to cause these people to change, they don't have a conscience. They don't care about Palestinians. They don't care about human rights law. They don't care about international law. The only thing they care about is their own hides. That's it. We have to make them fear for their own hides without actually engaging in violence. And I think if we're creative and persistent, we can come up with all kinds of ways to do that.
Well, we've seen that the laws are being crafted against any kind of action like that in France, in Britain, in America, in Canada, that's coming soon. I'm sure that they've already brought in these draconian policies in other regions. We saw what happened with the truckers that you were down there reporting on that as well. In the last minute we have, Dimitri, in your report, tensions rise on the Lebanon-Israel border. There's a segment in that, and that's again at dimitrilascaris.org, where you meet up with an Al Jazeera crew that's doing footage from the same vantage point where you are. They've had their correspondents murdered, Shireen Abu Akleh most prominently. But now, just a couple of days ago, their bureau chief in Gaza, Wael Dadud, saw his entire family wiped out, his nuclear family wiped out in an Israel air bombing there while they were sheltering in a refugee center. What about the danger posed to the kind of work that you've been doing, this reporting from the scene to reporters who seem obviously to be targeted?
The one other thing to mention is that during the past 10 days, the Israelis also killed two other journalists on the Israeli-Lebanon border, one of whom was a Reuters journalist. In that attack on the Reuters, and I was told that I didn't read this in the press. I was told by somebody who lived there in that very close by to the attack, that a missile went right through him, an Israeli missile, went through his body, and that six other just wounded in that attack. Two of them were from, I think at least two were from Al Jazeera. So Al Jazeera has been repeatedly targeted, and it is very clear that Israel is intentionally killing Al Jazeera journalists and their family members. Disgusting that we tolerate this, but it's happening. And it's because of the English language media organizations that have access to television, you know, are able to broadcast across televisions in the United States and Canada and Australia, and also broadcast in local languages in Western Europe. Of those organizations, Al Jazeera is by far the one that's most honest about what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinian people. That's why they are being targeted. And that's why I said in my article, I have the utmost respect for anybody who bears the name of an Al Jazeera journalist and is willing to put him or herself in the line of fire. Given what's happened in the last year, that takes extraordinary courage.
Well, Dmitry, your courage is a much needed inspiration to Canadians now who, like, as you allude, the Greek people to be, are largely politically and morally broken right now. I don't know if that can be repaired, but thanks a lot. I hope you get well, Dmitry. Thanks a lot for coming on. I want everyone to stick around. John Helmer is going to be here in the second half on the costs to Israel of this continuing outrage in Gaza, a very unique perspective. Thanks a lot, Dmitry.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle has taken you for walks in the park, but that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, is there method in this madness? Was the ruthless destruction of decency and the foundational principles of the West, and presumably Israel, the intention of the current onslaught in Gaza, and increasingly underscored by the marauding bands of murderous settlers in the West Bank? Or was it all just gotten away from the perennial felon Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, originally hoping perhaps just for a distraction from the determined and massive demonstrations against his government? Well, whither Israel then, and where does the disaster it has wrought for Palestine's people lead it now? John Helmer is a journalist and author who's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia, principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. Helmer has, too, been professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, and his latest SOVCOM plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out. John's latest article at Dances with Bears examines the question of what becomes of the only democracy in the Middle East now that its long-promised war is begun. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, John, your article veers far from the reporting I've seen of Israel's destruction of Palestine, focusing on the cost to it and its allies of this belligerence. Can we start with the title then, John?